All right, welcome everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I am the founder and host of the City's First podcast. We are really excited to welcome an esteemed guest here today, Andrew Savage from Lime. We'll kind of review Andrew's bio momentarily, but this is our 17th episode, actually. So we've been doing this for almost a year and a half now. And Andrew's joining us in our March episode to really talk about everything related to sustainability and micromobility and how these two themes converge at the city level, the operator level, and everything in between. So thanks, Andrew, for joining. We're really excited to kind of kick this off and do a really deep dive into this really timely topic here in 2024.
Great to be with you. Excited to be on the show.
Awesome. Great. So with that, without further ado, let's just kind of go through Andrew's bio, and then everyone kind of who's our, regular listeners knows our usual format. We'll just kind of go through the bio. We'll talk about a series of four or five questions, and then we'll kind of review what's next on the horizon. So with that, we'll just kind of get started here. So basically, on the founding team of Lime, the world's largest electric micromobility company operating in over 250 markets globally, Andrew Savage, Vice President of Sustainability, helped lead the company from its inception through expansion across more than 30 countries while raising over $750 million in investment. Serving on the company's executive team, Andrew built an organization which led Lime's market development, government relations, and policy strategy before creating and leading the sustainability function at the company, which is what we're talking about today. He was a twice elected member to the Solar Energy Industries Association Board of Directors, representing over 1,000 member businesses. While working in US Congress in DC, Andrew helped author and lead the US House of Representatives' passage of a $6 billion home energy retrofit program endorsed by President Barack Obama, which was also included in the 2022 IRA infrastructure bill. So, really exciting stuff. Great resume, great bio, Andrew. And I think this is super relevant for what we're going to talk about today. So, let's get started. So, basically, with these questions, I think we're going to start at the really high level, just so that kind of our listeners and audience knows, and we're going to get a little bit deeper into each subject with each subsequent question. So, first question for you, Andrew, is really around micromobility and Lime. So, what was micromobility and Lime like early on with cities, let's say starting in the US, and how has that changed and evolved over the last, let's say, 5 or 6 years?
Yeah, I mean that's a big topic. It could be its own podcast in its own right, but it's interesting. If you recall, the industry was actually called like the dockless bike industry not that many years ago, 5, 6 years ago. The term and the category of micromobility hadn't even been developed yet, and so needless to say, things have truly evolved dramatically since then. So in the early days of the industry, there was a lot of competition between the what was called dockless space, which was, in summary, just the free-floating nature of e-bikes and e-scooters that you see commonly today, against, in some ways, in an odd way, these sort of incumbent operators that many cities had adopted that relied on the station-based approach to bike sharing. And bear in mind, scooters hadn't really been developed in any way in a sharing capacity until about 6 years ago. And so, the nature of the industry was there was a lot of tension within micromobility even. And, I think there were some questions early on around whether or not this sort of new dockless and venture-backed model could work and be self-sustaining financially. We can address that. I think we've fully answered that question with our latest financials. But there was this tension around this new mode. And on one hand, we were out there really trying to help change mobility for the good. And we had a theory that if you could make bikes and scooters much more available to the public, that ridership would drastically increase, that you could help solve what we call like the first and last mile challenge within cities. And in many ways, I think we've been proven right that ridership has drastically increased. People have gravitated to the service because of the convenience and because of the availability. And it was, I think, a challenging road initially with cities. And that relationship has dramatically evolved, and I would say dramatically improved since the early days. And I came from, as you mentioned, a government background. So, here I was at, an early stage company with Lime, trying to forge relationships with city leaders to have them, see the virtues and the benefits of going with our service. And, we were advised really early on by the former mayor of Philadelphia, actually. We really were eager to be in New York City or be in Chicago or be in Miami. And, he sat us down. I remember really specifically sort of hitting the table as he enunciated this, saying, "You've got to crawl, you've got to walk, you've got to run." And what he meant was, you've got to build some reputation and service history and expertise and operational know-how with smaller cities. And so that's exactly what we did. Our first markets were UNC Greensboro, a small village outside of Miami called Key Biscayne in Florida. We then later on were able to move into slightly bigger cities, and Seattle was fairly early on. And we have now evolved where we now operate in over 200 cities, 280 cities globally. We operate in some of the biggest cities around the world, from Chicago, New York City, and DC to London, Paris, and Tel Aviv. And I think it was because of that methodological approach where we really took our time to understand the markets and work with cities. And that combination with having a true rider experience where people love the service and they both either find utility in the service because it gets them where they want to go efficiently, affordably, or they love the service and have a lot of joy taking it. And those are both great reasons to take micromobility.
Well, I love what you say around starting kind of crawl, walk, run, and that analogy in terms of approaching the cities with the right profile. So the small and mid-sized cities. Not only is that where the most commercial opportunity is, but that's where the most problems that need to be solved rest versus the mega cities. So I think that really focusing on that scale and then building your value proposition from there is the smart approach, whether it's in North America or Europe. So spot on, great, great insights, Andrew. Really refreshing to kind of hear that because that's really, I think, relevant across the value chain in mobility and urbanism. So really, really interesting to kind of hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's hard for startups, right? Startups want to go right for the biggest markets. And
They
I can
want to go to New
remember.
York, LA, whatever, mega cities, but you gotta be
Exactly.
pragmatic though. You have to, because that's really where your chance for success rests, basically. So next question, kind of a little bit more focused, on your work in sustainability now is, and kind of your what you manage is, how has Lime built the sustainability arm of the business, and how has that kind of grown and flourished over the last few years?
Sure. Again, a question that I think could be almost a whole podcast itself,
Spend the
but
whole time on just that
I'll
one.
try to make it condensed. But we really had to go from a company that was in survival mode and evolve. And when I say survival mode, in the early days of the industry, it was all about market expansion and getting into certain markets and growing ahead of your competition, and can you get in ahead of markets? Because there was this feeling that if you weren't the first app download, you weren't ever going to make up for that. And we've really gone from this notion of survival to living out our mission around sustainability. And what it took was really building the muscle of building sustainability into the fabric of the company. And capturing the similar motif of crawl, walk, run, we've done a very similar thing on the sustainability front. I mean, it would be great if you could snap your fingers and immediately we'd be a net zero company, but I think we all know that that's virtually impossible. But similar to how we expanded to markets, we have taken sustainability and just continuously held ourselves to a higher and higher standard, and try to hit singles and not be not be dissuaded by the notion that you can't get everything done all at once. So the first thing that we did on the sustainability front was we committed to 100% renewable energy for all charging of our shared vehicles, so e-bikes and e-scooters. And that was just a the first it was a first for the industry, but a first for Lime as well. And from there, we've continuously doubled down on the work around sustainability at Lime, committing to all electric operational vehicles, so swapping out the vans from diesel or gas vans to electric vans, obviously right in line with our mission and something, again, I'd love to snap my fingers and make it all 100% right now. We're over 60%, which is a great, great progress from where we started. But essentially, we've really just taken this sort of bottom-up approach of just knocking out things that we can do on the sustainability front to continuously up-level our work. But at the same time, we've also set a very high overarching standard for the company. So for our listeners who may be aware, the Science Based Targets Initiative is essentially the gold standard for companies setting carbon targets. You know, they don't allow carbon offsets to be used to meet goals. They have very strict standards around aligning with the Paris Climate Accord. And we looked at that standard and said, well, that's going to be ambitious, but we better set ourselves to that high ambition because otherwise we just wouldn't be doing right by our mission. And so, you know, we back in 2019 committed to setting a science-based target. We very quickly went through the very rigorous validation process. No sooner have we gotten validated, the first in the industry, but then they came out with their net zero standard. And we said, well, you know what? We're not going to be lime and, you know, fulfill our mission if we don't commit to that standard as well. So we went back through the process again, resetting a science-based target, aligning it with net zero for 2030, and then very quickly got that validation through SBTi, again, the first for the industry. And so I tell that because I think it speaks to the culture within the company of setting an incredibly high standard and also speaks to the culture of the company of having a real commitment to the mission around decarbonizing the future of mobility and cities. And we think this is just such an important thing that we both get it right as a company, but then we're also part of the solution within the cities that we operate. I mean, we love seeing things like Madrid or other markets around the world where they're saying, you know what? Cars in this zone, we're going to prohibit them, or gas vehicles in this zone, we're going to prohibit them. It's all headed in the right direction around decarbonizing and making cities more livable. And we feel like we have a really significant role to play in that. And so at the same time as we're doing the real things like the renewable energy and the swapping out electric vehicles, and we have a ton of other initiatives that we're working on. Like this week, we announced a commitment to using 100% EV trucks from port to our distribution hubs, just yet another way to be able to live out our mission, but also setting ourselves to a standard around the corporate goals that we're setting and how we measure ourselves from a macro perspective as well.
I mean, the very definition of micromobility is decarbonization of transport and sustainable modal shifts. So by realizing that mission and setting your targets, aligning with multiple certifications, you're just kind of realizing and manifesting, you know, what is this opportunity throughout kind of a macro scale in the industry. And obviously, what you are doing at Lime is kind of an industry standard. So it's really great to hear in terms of how you're quantifying this, how you're implementing, and how you're actually making this actionable towards this, let's say, long-term public policy shift. So it's really heartening to hear that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I should say also that for those who aren't aware, you know, in the micromobility space, I mean, one of the big things that we all measure ourselves by is the mode shift that we can see in the markets that we operate of people that are taking a bike or a scooter or another micromobility device instead of a higher emitting vehicle, typically personal car, taxi, ride hail. Ride hails are significantly more emitting than personal cars, typically because of the deadheading effect of driving around until you get a ride or driving to the ride. And so, you know, we hold ourselves to a really high standard there as well, where we constantly are talking with our riders through surveys, et cetera, to find out what is the mode shift of our service. And this varies, obviously, globally, dramatically from North America into Europe, et cetera. But, you know, across the board, one in every five trips that we provide is preventing a personal car trip or a taxi or ride hail trip. So a very, very high emitting mode. But, you know, we've also found through significant work that we've done on both our life cycle analyses of our service, as well as through some research by the Fraunhofer Institute, which is a leading institute in Germany, that the net impact of our service, when you look at all the mode shifts, even people that decide, you know what, I just actually, it's raining out, I don't want to walk that half a mile, I'm going to actually take a bike to get there faster or what have you. When you look at all the mode shifts, including walking, including induced trips of trips that people might not have even taken scooter or bike to joyride or go see a museum. You look at all of those and you look at our life cycle analyses, and on average, every single kilometer taken from an e-scooter globally saves over 26 grams of CO2. And similarly, each kilometer on an e-bike saves 16 grams. That's average globally through this study. And that looks at things like even including public transportation, of which some modes were actually now have a lower life cycle emissions than some public transportation. So, you know, we're strong advocates for linking with public transportation. You know, we in many ways partner with public transit agencies, and we see a lot of people who take public transport and then hop on a bike or scooter for the last mile, or vice versa. They take a bike or scooter to get to public transport. So we see ourselves as very much in partnership with those modes. But overall, what we're talking about is trying to lower the carbon emissions within cities and trying to do that through both our own work as well as providing a great service that can link up with other public services as well.
It's a multimodal journey. It's the inverted pyramid, Andrew. So it's basically, you know, you want the fewest amount of trips by automobile and the greatest amount of trips on top by walking or active modes. And it all kind of moves down the pyramid from there. And really, what this is about in terms of this theme of decarbonization of the transport sector is ameliorating and undoing the poor policy choices of the 20th century in terms of urbanism, in terms of the built environment, and in terms of our cities and our regions. So basically what we're doing is we're trying to undo a lot of these mistakes that have taken place over the last century. And the opportunity and the possibilities are there, but it's going to take a lot of work. However, micromobility and sustainable modal shift are really the key measures for success in this policy shift, though, of course.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, just
picture. But I'm an urban planner, so I had to weave in that urbanism theme and a little bit of the historical context around that, though.
Yeah. Well, not to preach to the choir here, but just picture how much space personal cars take up in cities of today. And speaking of the mistakes of the past, I mean, you know, cars, whether they're an electric car or a gas car or what have you, they sit idle. they sit idle 96% of the time that they live, right? And they occupy such an enormous part of our city landscape, from curbside, which could otherwise be protected bike lanes or cafes and, you know, and outside eateries or parklets, to enormous superstructures where they sit in, you know, parking garages. And you can imagine that being affordable housing so people can live and work near all in one, you know, 10 or 15 minute neighborhood. And so if you think about getting rid of the need for those cars and how much space it frees up, you can really envision a much more vibrant, a much more livable, a much more fun city. And in many ways, we're so hamstrung by the dominance of how much space cars take up in our current urban environment, even with the progress that we've already made.
Less Robert Moses, more Jane Jacobs. That's what we need. That's it.
There you go.
And micromobility plays a key role in that, in reclaiming our public spaces and taking back our cities. That's really what it's about. So, and this has been going on, like I said, for over a century, but we're seeing a lot of really positive momentum, especially since the pandemic, where urbanists and other key stakeholders are really starting to take a leadership role. So I see a lot of positive momentum in this direction.
Yeah, and it's things that we didn't even have the technical capacity to do just that so many years ago. I mean, just think about what the combination of a smartphone, which allows you to have sort of, you know, palm access to the world, combined with, you know, lithium ion battery, which can power an electric device, which can move you, you know, using a 60 pound e-scooter, e-bike versus a 3, 4, or 6,000 ton car. And, you know, that really, it could have been done through sort of traditional old means, but you never would have had the scale and the user experience and the operational know-how and ability to sort of manage a fleet of hundreds of thousands of vehicles like we do today.
Yeah. Yeah. So it plays in the issues of accessibility, equity, democratization of modes, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of other themes that we could probably kind of, you know, focus on as a follow-up, I'm sure. But let's get on to our next topic here. which is around kind of different form factors in micromobility. So the question for you is, what are the most important form factors in scooter and bike share design that encourage mode shift? So kind of back to that theme around mode shift, and how can these form factors kind of play into this, let's say, decarbonization theme?
Yeah, I mean, it's something we think a lot about. And if you look at the sort of, I guess I would say, fairly short arc of Lime, you know, we have, at least personally as a company, seen a shift from starting with bikes,
Start with bikes, that's right.
very quickly realizing e-bikes were truly the way to go, although they required a bit more sort of operational expertise that we would only gain with time. But they were quickly sort of, you know, outclassed by e-scooters. And e-scooters have become by far the preferred sort of stationless mode of transport, at least within the United States. But I should also say that we are seeing the e-bikes returning in many ways. And there's some, I think, some reasons for it. I think e-scooters were seen as a very accessible, sort of effort-free way to move about a city. And that's a great thing. And they were seen as accessible because, you know, people weren't, you know, expecting to get sweaty using them. You could step right onto it versus the, you know, stepping into a bike. You're thinking about, you know, the old days of getting your pant leg dirty with grease or what have you. There was an accessibility factor with e-scooters. I think it also turned people onto the notion that e-mobility, e-micromobility could be incredibly beneficial and accessible. And so I think now that people expect to either see an e-scooter or an e-bike, which will have a similar ease, a similar assist from an electric motor, et cetera, I think we've seen e-bikes come roaring back. You know, we've seen markets where some people tend to use an e-bike for a slightly longer journey versus an e-scooter for a shorter journey. I know personally, my experience recently in Berlin, one of our company's largest, you know, global markets. You know, when I would take a longer trip, I would tend to like an e-bike better. I would also say, without sharing more than I'm permitted at the moment, that we're looking at, you know, third and fourth modes that allow for a further expansion of form factor to meet the demand of customers. So, you know, what might be even more accessible to certain populations, particularly women who haven't been, you know, who in many ways have had safety concerns about e-biking and e-scooting, who you know, might want a smaller vehicle type, people who might want to stop at the grocery store on the way back from work. So what type of you know, what type of equipment do we include to allow for a small amount of transport? Things like that that we look at and survey our riders about to understand, to your initial question, how do we boost mode shift? How do we allow for our service to provide more to more people within a city environment? Because if we can do that, we can get rid of more and more and more of those cars and provide better and better linkages to public transport and other things, and provide a service that people actually are either delighted by or get a great amount of utility from, or and hopefully both.
I would just caution that we shouldn't be pitting one mode against the next, though. And I'm sure you would agree that we should think of this kind of multimodal offer of, let's say, boosting equity and access to all different profiles and user groups as a win for all of our cities. And basically, by providing a range of modes, kind of in, like, let's say, a toolbox type of methodology, then we're able to basically improve accessibility as well as modality to promote these themes around a sustainable modal shift so that everyone has a choice based upon their own personal or user preferences and not, let's say, like I said, kind of pit one mode against the next. And we have this kind of very binary, black or white scenario. And I think that that's a bit problematic for cities right now, whether it's in North America or Europe, where we're kind of faced with challenging, is it e-bikes or e-scooters? Yes or no? I mean, we should think more inclusively of all modes fitting into this kind of sustainable ecosystem of modalities. And I think that, at least personally, that's my view, is that's what we should all be aiming for from a public policy perspective.
Yeah, I would agree completely. There's no need to sort of pit one mode against another. It just we want more of it all.
More of
I
it
would
all.
say that from a public policy perspective, there are times that, you know, that companies like Lime are sort of forced into more of one mode or another because
Of
of public
course.
policy. Like a city may say, we want more of this and
Because
less of
that's the
this.
market
And
you're in. Yeah, of course.
yeah, and that's not necessarily what the public is saying, but it is what the
No.
public representatives are saying. So it is a
There's a,
tricky dynamic and one you're
yeah.
constantly in
There is.
a, you know, in a dialogue with. And that's why we have such a great, you know, team that engages on the public realm and works with city leaders and, you know, mayors, et cetera, to get it right and to get it as right as possible.
It's tricky, but there is a little bit of a difference between public representation and actual public demand of modality. So, but again, that's a whole other topic we can probably follow up at a later date. So, all right. So our next topic I'd like to chat about is a little bit more back to this kind of partnership theme. So, the question for you is, how can operators and cities strengthen partnerships to achieve better public policies? So, kind of related to the last question, but a little bit more of a segue into this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the best things that we can do and we do regularly with our city partners is sharing aggregate data. And that means essentially being able to inform and arm cities with data from the hundreds of thousands of trips being taken within a particular jurisdiction to help them make riding safer and more seamless. And I remember the first time, this was way back, I th think it was right before the pandemic, when we were sharing aggregate data, which means not, you know, individual trips, but sort of the, you know, the aggregate as a whole with the city of Seattle. And they actually used very specific data that we shared to justify capital investments in protected bike lanes. And just that connection for me personally was sort of just magical because it was like, wow, we can actually arm cities with information that they've long wanted and needed so that they make biking, riding, scooting safer for us all. And we've done that, you know, time and time again. And, you know, post-pandemic or even during the pandemic, you saw a lot of cities that doubled down on their investment in infrastructure and bike and pedestrian infrastructure in particular. And we've seen a proliferation of that and a continuation of that. And I think that's one of the best ways that we as operators can support cities. And, you know, we also work with them in thinking about where are parking corrals best located, again, based on data that we can provide and furnish them. So I think that's one of the best types of sort of partnerships with public entities, you know, in addition to integrations with public transport, which we also talked about. But I think, you know, as someone who, you know, cares deeply about how, you know, cities operate and the government side of things, you know, I can just see there being tremendous opportunities to continue to partner in those ways going forward.
Yeah, data-driven insights are really key to having a meaningful conversation, and we move past the kind of anecdotal, one-off, let's say, kind of notions of new modalities and perceived, let's say, preferences, bias towards things that are actionable and quantifiable. So I think that's really key to actually making a meaningful change. So I fully agree with you, Andrew, on that. I think we have time for one really brief question, then we'll have to kind of round this off here. Which is, tell us about your mentoring work at Harvard's iLab and Techstars and how it strengthens the startup ecosystem. So, just a few minutes of your time on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say there is, you know, I spend a little bit of time, you know, on the side trying to help the climate tech ecosystem thrive. And, you know, we learned a lot at Lime, growing as quickly as we did, raising the amount of capital that we had to. You know, people were coming to us from very, very fast growing startups like Uber and other startups saying, wow, like we thought Uber was growing quickly. Lime, you guys are growing like beyond what we could ever imagine. And it was true. It was a very crazy time. We were growing incredibly quickly. But what we learned from that, I think, can be passed along to other founders and other leaders. And so, you know, I do try to spend a little bit of time helping other climate tech startups and other through other incubators to help usher in the next generation of innovations that are going to help improve cities, improve the environment, improve how energy is produced, et cetera. And so, you know, I've had the fortune to be able to work with some really interesting early stage companies. I love the work because in many ways, you know, at now 7+ years old, Lime, we're getting to become sort of a mid to later stage company, if you can sort of imagine it, which seems somewhat shocking to say because it still feels very much like we're a startup. But there's a big difference between a company that's going from, you know, zero to one to get off the ground. And so, you know, I try to spend a little bit of time working with those companies, try to make some introductions that could be helpful to them, in hopes that we'll see some great new innovations and great companies that deliver some services that we vastly need.
Can't wait to see those startups thrive and kind of manifest. That's great, great news.
Same with me. Yeah, same with me.
Yeah, I'm sure it's really satisfying. So thanks, Andrew. So let's kind of wrap it up here. So where can we find you, you know, on social media and other channels?
I was going to say initially when I heard, where can you find me? I was going to say, well, it's getting to spring here in Burlington, Vermont. So you'll find me on, you know, gravel roads.
Now, yeah.
Gravel roads on my bike, or maybe
you're in mud season now, right?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Ski, you know, late spring skiing with the kids. But no, I'm definitely accessible on LinkedIn. Folks can find me there. But yeah, I really appreciate you having me on the show and the conversation. I think the journey of Lime is a fun one to talk about, only because I hope it inspires others to leap in and do similar things.
Absolutely. No, it's been our pleasure, Andrew. Really happy to have you. I'm sure we'll have another part two or another chat soon in any one of these deep dives. But thank you, Andrew, so much for your time. And thanks to the audience for being our kind of active, loyal listeners on this 17th episode of the City's First Podcast. I'll look for this episode to be published momentarily on all channels such as Spotify, Google, Amazon, etc. And we'll be having our next episode in April come up soon. And with that, thanks again, Andrew, and look forward to collaborating with you in the future.
Thanks so much, Scott, and keep doing the great work you're doing.
Thank you.